Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, it's been an exciting end to the summer of 2016 in astronomy and space exploration. I've got a mission that's starting, a mission that's in progress, and a mission that's ending to talk about. Briefly, the mission that's in progress, first of all, is the Gaia mission from the European Space Agency. This is making a 3D map of the sky. It's mapped the positions of about a billion stars, and for about 2 million of them, it's got their 3D positions, so it's made a 3D map of millions of stars in our galaxy, which is a fantastic achievement, letting us understand more about the origins of various stars in our galaxy and the history of the Milky Way, something called, rather enigmatically, galactic archaeology, which is rather exciting. So the data sets there are out there, and there's lots for students at schools to look at as well as astronomy researchers around the world. If you're interested in school projects involving Gaia data and mapping stars and finding and analysing supernovae, exploding stars as well, then do go and find the Gaia UK website, gaia.ac.uk. In terms of the other missions, the one that's starting, the one that's ending, these are both involving visits to tiny objects out in space. So not going to planets, but going to very small objects, comets and asteroids. The mission that's starting, we'll talk about later, is OSIRIS-REx, but the mission that's coming to an end is arguably the most exciting mission in solar system exploration over recent years, the Rosetta mission, and the tiny Philae lander that it released onto the surface of comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, or 67P to its friends, and I think that's what I'll stick to for the rest of this. To find out more about Rosetta and what it's up to, I need to chat to Professor Monica Grady from the Open University. Welcome to the programme, Monica.
Hi, hello.
So you're a comet expert. You're involved in exploring comets and asteroids in our solar system. This mission Rosetta and its little lander Philae that went down to the surface must have been a considerable boon to your field in terms of what it's revealed.
Yeah, the Rosetta mission has been absolutely stunning in some of the things that we found out. I mean, the images just by themselves, you know, have been worth the, you know, the price tag of the mission, but everything else as well. It's been amazing.
And so the mission itself is actually been going a long time. It launched, is it 12 years ago now that it actually launched? So 2004, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. It launched in 2004, but it should have launched in 2003, but there was a technical hitch with the rocket launcher. But of course, you know, the instruments that people were building were being designed and built since about 1995. So it seems to have been going on and on and on forever. Okay, you know, we forgot about it for a bit while it was out in deep space, but then it came back again. And it's been part of my scientific life for a long, long time. And when it comes to an end at the end of September, it's going to be bizarre. It's going to be really like, oh!
So you can't be alone in people who've had a good chunk of their career has involved Rosetta in some sense or another.
Yeah, I'm only a very minor bit player. I haven't built an instrument or designed an instrument. My position or my association with the Rosetta mission is that I work at the Open University, where a team here built the Ptolemy instrument, which is on Philae, and I'm one of the scientific advisors to that instrument team. So I've played a really, really small role, and you know, those people who have given, well, it's an exaggeration to say given their scientific lives to this mission, you know, they're going to feel, they might feel a hole, but actually I know what they're all up to. They're all designing an instrument to go for a mission to the moon. So it's like one mission ends and another opens up. So it's sort of, oh, yeah, Rosetta's finished. Yeah, okay, well, never mind. We're thinking about the moon now.
Yeah. Well, in terms of Rosetta itself, we should probably say what the what the mission was and what it was aimed to do. So it was going to visit and to go into orbit around this comet, as I said, 67P. I will avoid trying to pronounce its full name for the duration of this, I suspect. And to release a lander onto the surface to study the comet. Can you tell us why we want to know about comets in that much detail?
Well, comets are leftovers from the birth of the solar system. So our star, the Sun, was born in a turbulent cloud of gas and dust about 4,567 million years ago. And the dust collapsed into the planets. And at the outer fringes of this cloud, which collapsed to become a disk, there was ice formed. And that's where the comets grew. And they're all leftovers from this planet and star forming process. So they're the really primitive bits that haven't been changed since the Sun first formed. And so when we study comets, we're studying stuff from the birth of our solar system, which is, you know, pretty mind-blowing.
So if you look at stuff on our Earth or on any of the Moon or any of the large objects we visit, that's been modified by a smorgasbord of processes that have gone on over the last 4,567 million years.
4,567 million years, you know, so a good number to remember, isn't it? 4,567. And I mean, the Earth formed from this same dust, and so did Mars, and so did Venus, but they've been, that dust in these planets has been changed because it's as the planets formed, they were very, very hot inside, and the Earth still is. It's got a molten core. So the primitive dust has changed a lot. And then the Moon didn't form from primitive dust. It formed from the surface of the Earth in a giant impact. So that has changed completely as well. So the only stuff that really represents the original material is stuff that hasn't been melted, and that's some of the asteroids in the asteroid belts which haven't been melted, but they haven't got all that primitive ice in and the gases trapped in the ice which comets have. So comets are just really, really exciting and interesting objects. And Pluto as well, you know, we used to think that Pluto was a planet, which implied that it had been through these sort of formation processes, but it actually looks as if Pluto isn't a planet. We're now calling it a Kuiper Belt object, and they're also very primitive, haven't been through all these melting processes. So it's, you know, we've got a lot of stuff that we still need to find out about.
And so Rosetta was sent to Comet 67P to find out more about this. Now 67P is on an orbit that takes it out to around Jupiter, and then close-ish to Jupiter's orbit, and then swings it back into just inside Mars's orbit, I believe. So significantly further away from the Earth, and that's one of the reasons that Rosetta took so long to get there.
Well, yes, it's partly that. It's partly the speed at which the comet is travelling. Our spacecraft had to build up its speed, and it can only do that by picking up momentum from planets as it passes. So it went past the Earth three times, and it went past Mars once to pick up this extra momentum so it could be travelling fast enough so that the difference in its speed and the comet's speed was at a minimum. So it caught up with the comet, and it's rode alongside the comet for several months, taking lots and lots of pictures of the surface of the comet so that we knew more about it before Philae landed.
And then when the mission has been going on, and the Philae lander that landed, and we talked when Philae landed on this program a while ago about all the excitement with that landing itself. It didn't go entirely as planned, but largely was a great success. What have we learned from Rosetta and the results from Philae?
Well, from Philae, we've been studying the solid part of the comet, and we know a bit more about what the comet's made of in terms of the organic molecules. From Rosetta, we've learned more about the gases and the dust grains as they've come from the surface of the comet, and how much gas there is and how much dust, and what elements are present there. And there's a surprisingly large amount of oxygen, a surprisingly large amount of the noble gases like argon, which wasn't expected at all. We've seen seen a whole range of variety of organic compounds of different types, including things like glycine and the starting materials for sucrose, which are, of course, the building blocks of life. We've seen phosphorus there, which is another element necessary for life. So there's been a lot of compositional information, plus also things like spectroscopy, which showed how black the surface of the comet is, which shows that it's been interacting with cosmic radiation to a greater extent than we'd thought. And then there's also, of course, the amazing images from the OSIRIS camera. Fantastic cameras from images from the navigation camera, but these ones from the main camera on board have been sensational. And they've started a new field, which is the morphology of small bodies, which sounds a bit odd. I'll explain, what it is. I mean, if you think of the Earth, and you think of the processes that have gone on Earth, when you do geography at school, you learn about V-shaped river valleys and U-shaped glacial valleys and hanging valleys and rivers that meander and all these things. You learn about freeze-thaw processes and all these sort of things that you can explain in terms of rivers and glaciers and wind and stuff. And we're seeing similar features on the surface of this comet, but there's no rivers there, there's no glaciers. There isn't anywhere near as much ice on the surface as we thought. There are pictures that show things that look as if they're strata, as if they're layers of different rocks, which on Earth we would think they were different lava flows or different types of rock laid down in water. Completely not valid explanations for these features on the comet. So we're having to come up with a new set of explanations for how some of these features are formed on comets. Now, freeze-thaw is one process which will work, but the other process is what happens when the ice thaws. It doesn't form water, it sublimes directly into a gas. And so what happens then is any dust flies off the surface of the comet, but also then might fall back again, producing layers of dust of different size grains. They form sort of wind shadows behind rocks and things like that. So it's really interesting to see a field of inquiry developing sort of, on a daily basis.
I think the images of 67P, I remember when they first came out, okay, there was the odd thing that it's a very odd-shaped object. It's the shape of a rubber duck, if you like. It seemed to be what became the meme about that early on. But the fact that the images showed, I think, landscapes almost on the comet.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, landscapes, they actually are, they look like landscapes. They look like valleys. They look like hills. They look like series of sediments and layers. And then the way they're carved in is in a different way. It's not carved, presumably, by a river running through or even a great big mass of ice running through, because ice doesn't work like that on a comet, because you've got something which is free-floating. Well, it's not free-floating in space, it's bound by the sun, but it hasn't got the same gravitational attraction, which way's up, which way's down on this very small object. It's only 4 kilometers across. So you can't think of ice moving in the same way as it moves on Earth when it's under the force of gravity. So it's most of the carving of the landforms must have been done by actually sublimation of ice combined with cratering from other objects hitting 67P.
And there's a fantastic range of images and results that have come out of it. Presumably there's an awful lot of analysis still going on.
Oh, absolutely. Enough to keep, your cometary morphologists off the street for years. There's tons of stuff to do.
And you mentioned at the start that all the people who'd worked on the instruments for this were now working on future missions, on a mission to the moon, for example. Presumably, the way most scientific missions work is you send a mission to a new object, you answer a few of your questions. You raise, as you've discussed, a whole ton of other questions about how those processes work. Are there plans now for future missions to go to other comets? Have those changed as a result of Rosetta's discoveries?
Well, it takes a long, long time to get a mission accepted. And so the European Space Agency at the moment is going through mission proposals for missions which won't launch until about, I don't know, 2025, 2030, something like that. And there are missions to comets in those, yes. Now, the ultimate mission that we would like to do is a comet return, comet sample return. The Americans, NASA, brought some cometary material back from a comet, Vild 2, a few years ago. But they only brought the dust back. They didn't bring the ice back. They didn't bring the gas back. And the way they got the grains compromised any organic material that was in the sample. So what we really want to do is go to a comet and, you know, bring a shovel full of it back, including the gas, the dust, the ice, and making sure that it's not contaminated so that we can analyse the organics. That's going to be very difficult, very, very expensive. It'll take a lot of planning.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that getting samples is an important step. There is actually another mission that, as Rosetta finishes, another mission starts. The OSIRIS-REx mission, which is a NASA mission, launched a few weeks ago, and that's off to visit an astronaut. It's off to visit an asteroid. Yeah, that's got a slightly easier name to remember. Asteroid Bennu. I think that's how
that's
you pronounce
right.
It.
Yeah.
A bit less of a mouthful. And that is actually planning a sample return. Now, one of the big distinctions here, of course, is that Bennu is an asteroid, not a comet. Does that make a big difference to your planning?
It does make a difference. I mean, the asteroids live most of the time in the asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter, and they, by and large, don't have anywhere near as much ice in them as the comets. In fact, for a long time, we thought they had no ice at all, but the results from Ceres, the biggest of the asteroids, which is being orbited by the Dawn mission at the moment, that has shown that there is actually ice in some of these asteroids. We've known for a long time through study of meteorites, which come from asteroids, that they have had water and ice on them in the past, but we'd sort of assumed that had all gone, but it looks as if it hasn't. But anyway, Bennu isn't in the asteroid belt. It's a near-Earth object, and so it's much closer to the Earth than actually the asteroid belt. And if you believe the asteroid forecasters, it is possibly on a collision course with the Earth for 2175, I think it is. So, you know, for another 150 or so years. And what OSIRIS-REx is going to do is it's going to take a year to go around the sun, and then it's going to do a flyby of the Earth again to pick up enough momentum to get to Bennu, and then it will orbit Bennu for a bit, and then it's got a tag on it which stands for touch and go. That's right. The touch and go sample analysis system. And so what it's going to do is it's going to hover over the surface of Bennu and send a blast of nitrogen onto the surface, which will hopefully dislodge material from the surface and send a whole load of it back into the sample analysis chamber. And depending on how much they manage to get off, they'll bring between, 100 grams and 2 kilograms or something. It's just like there might be an enormous amount comes back. And so that will be back at the end 2021, is it coming back? But it'll be that'll be really exciting when that comes back as well, because that is a very carbon rich type of meteorite, and again a carbon rich asteroid, sorry. And again, when we have these asteroids come through the Earth's atmosphere and arrive as meteorites, they are all contaminated to some extent just coming through the Earth's atmosphere. So to get something which is pristine, we hope, from this space mission, brackets unless you want to analyze nitrogen, I suppose, which is one of the main things I'm interested in. I must ask the PI what implications it had. But yeah, so that'll be really interesting. That'll be really great when that comes back.
And being able to do all the analysis in the labs here on Earth. I mean, Rosetta and OSIRIS-REx, I'm sure, have all sorts of a suite of instruments on board. I know Philae, the lander, had various chemistry experiments on board, some built by the Open University, but they're no match, as advanced as they are, they're no match for actually having a full-blown lab here on Earth, I assume.
That's true. I mean, it's like you want to go to, you want to find out about a body. How can you do it? Well, you can go and analyze it in situ there. And it's like you're there. There's no worries about contamination. You know, you can absolutely make the measurements. But you can't repeat the measurements in 10 years' time. Hmm. You know, you can't repeat them, you know, in 5 minutes' time. There are some experiments that you simply can't do up in space at the moment. And so ideally, the two sets of instruments go hand in hand. So we've had analyses of meteorites, and then we had a probe went to Halley's Comet, and we learned stuff from that. We did more analyses of asteroids and meteorites. Now we've had the Stardust mission, the Hayabusa mission, Rosetta mission, and in between time, the analysis of meteorites and bits of asteroid keeps going on. And you learn from each mission, and you think, right, okay, what have we learned from Rosetta, which we might be able to study on meteorites? And it's this hard surface and the radiation damage. You know, that's one of the things that is going to be really interesting to follow up. So the space mission and the lab missions go absolutely hand in hand.
It's certainly it's going to be incredibly revealing to get these samples back on Earth, and exciting to be able to. I mean, I've got on my desk at home, I've got a tiny little sample of Mars, or at least it's in a box that says there's a bit of Mars. I won it in a competition, so I have no reason to doubt it. So you can get to know that you're holding a piece of one of these objects. And there are various, I know there are kits for schools where you can say, look, here's a bit of the moon. You can hold a bit of the moon and so on.
Yes, I mean the Research Council, STFC, has a public engagement arm, and they lend out suitcases which contain meteorites in, pieces of the moon, pieces of Mars, which were provided by the Natural History Museum. And so a school can borrow these, or an astronomy club can borrow these for a week or a couple of nights or whatever. And so people can actually see and touch and feel some of these really, really amazing bits of rock. And the moon is fascinating, Mars is fascinating, but for me, when you hold one of these meteorites that are 4,567 million years old, and you know, it is the oldest thing you'll ever hold. It has come from the furthest distance that you can think of, and it is just we're so lucky to be able to have these amazing samples.
It's certainly a wonderful thing to be able to do. Now, taking us back into space for just to finish, you know, the Rosetta mission is due to come to an end on the 30th of September, and the mission is not just gonna get turned off. They're actually going to, depending on how you phrase it, either land or crash the probe onto the comet. What's the rationale for trying to lower the probe onto the comet in that way?
Well, first of all, it's got to come to an end because the comet is now moving away from the sun, and Rosetta is powered by solar panels. So it's got barely enough power anymore. So it's very soon going to run out of power completely. So the idea is to very gently bring it down onto the surface. And it's been doing orbital maneuvers for the last few weeks, bringing it lower and lower and lower and closer to the surface. And again, we've had some amazing images. And the idea is that all its, as many of its instruments as possible will still be working as it lands. They're trying to reduce the speed as much as possible so that it isn't a catastrophic crash, and the hope is that the camera will keep working as it actually lands on the surface. But I don't think it will keep working for much longer after that, because Rosetta might be working, but it's got to be able to transmit its signals back to the Earth. And of course, the comet is rotating, so there will be times when Rosetta cannot transmit. So we don't know how long the transmission will last, if for any length of time at all. And of course, once it goes into eclipse, once it goes into darkness, then the power will drain fairly readily from the batteries, and it will not power up again.
Well, it's certainly going to be an exciting event. I know the European Space Agency have a ton of activities planned for the final day of Rosetta.
I mean, what has been marvellous is that last week they found Philae. The pictures of Philae taken by Rosetta, it's like, yay! Our little probe's there!
It's a fitting end, I suppose. I know there was a lot of debate as to exactly where Philae landed, because it wasn't transmitting for very long.
That's right. I mean, instead of landing on its feet in the middle of a sort of sunlit plain, it landed on its side underneath an overhanging cliff down a crevasse. But at least we've found it now, and that allows you to put context on some of the results that have been got. It's like, oh right, well that explains that result then.
I look forward to certainly the end of the mission. It'll be a happy, sad occasion. It's certainly everything does have to come to an end, and look forward to future missions. So, Monica Grady from the Open University, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I certainly look forward to hearing more about the OSIRIS-REx mission over coming months and years. Back here on Earth, the nights are drawing in. We're past the autumn equinox. That means the nights are now longer than the days. And while it can be a little bit sad if you like the daylight, it does mean that nights are getting darker, getting darker earlier if you don't want to have to stay up as late to look at the sky. And it means that possibly after your dinner, you can pop outside and look up at the skies and see what's going on up there. It's the autumn skies and the winter skies that will be coming in a few months. Some of the best all of the year. So it's well worth stepping outside and gazing skywards. You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.